My name is Janice Goodman, and my title is Coordinator, Inter-Lutheran Native American Concerns. And I work for the Pacific Northwest Synod of the LCA and the North Pacific District of the ALC. And I want to open today by thanking you who are here. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I have been taught that you who are older than I am, old enough to be my grandmother, are my grandmother. And you who are old enough to be my grandfather, you are my grandfather. You who are my mother's age are my mother and my father. And you who are my age are very much my sisters and brothers. And you who are younger are my children. And I care about that a tremendous amount. And I appreciate being able to take this time before you. I am sensing a youngness in me as I begin this work, this ministry. And I appreciate your willingness to allow me to do this. I wonder if we could begin with a prayer. Could you please stand and turn and face the east? Thank you. As we look to the east, as we see the village center, we visualize the art. Thank you for Rich. We turn to the east and we see Narnia and the ministry of those who love the young. We look down the hill and we see that beautiful lake. We send out a prayer, a vision. Almost riding on the back of an eagle, we look to the east. We see the broad plateau, the Columbia. We see the hills of the Okanagan. We fly in greater action and motion and visualize the entire Western United States, even, you know, going further east. We see our whole beautiful land curving gently and roundly ahead of us. We see the morning sun. We see the beautiful blue Atlantic, green and cool, full of fish and life. We see our sisters and brothers and grandmothers and grandfathers in Europe, in Norway, and Sweden, in the Middle East, and South Africa. Our vision bursts forth from this place in the direction of the east. And suddenly we know that as we look in the east, we see our vision turning back upon ourselves. And we wonder at creation. Let us turn to the south. And as we look to the south, we see the mine, we see the tailings, we see the copper, we see the dusty orange blood of Mother Earth poured out and puddled, scabbed and crying in front of us. We see the ugliness that resulted in our search for wealth, particular mineral wealth. And yet that is almost diminished by the beauty of the mountain, the wonder of the stars in the sky. We think about the South, Portland and California, and we think of our sisters and brothers in Central and South America. We send our vision out across the Pacific, the South Pacific, and the South Atlantic. We let our soul leave this place and sense our relationship and connectedness to those that exist to the south of us in this direction. Let us turn to the west. And as we look to the west, from here we see the great beauty and wonder of the mountains, the beauty and extraordinary joy that comes from the experience of looking to the passes and to the tops of the Rockies, the white, cold snow, and knowing that beyond that are the population areas of Seattle and our families, even some of us, parents and children. We see the broad expanse of the Pacific. And we know that our hearts go out to the people in Japan and China and Russia even, somehow connected to us in this moment as we turn to the north. And we send out a vision to the north, to our brothers and sisters in Canada, to the peoples who have traveled there from all over the world, to those who speak in other languages across that country. We see the North Pole, pristine and pure, clear and cold, strong, Alaska and its wealth of oil and mineral. We also see jets and missiles pointed across the north toward our brothers and sisters in Russia and China. We see planes that carry people back and forth across that great north country. And we feel our connectedness to the people of the north. Return to the east, please, and look down a moment and see the very stones at our feet. In fact, wait a minute, don't go too fast. Stop and see yourself. Experience and celebrate your existence here. You are the child of the 77th generation. Why are you here? Imagine the miracle of your ancestors that brought you to this place. See it. Love it. Love the earth we stand on. The heat and fire and creativity, the energy that flows beneath us. Celebrate and know that the earth is sacred and your life is sacred. And now maybe you could look up. Look to this direction, to these peace cranes, lifting us to a vision of peace within and without, to this beautiful wooden structure, the trees, the grandfathers surrounding us, embracing us in this place, warming us, protecting us, giving us shelter, the clouds bringing us life, the water that renews and restores, revives, recreates us. The sky, the very embrace of God, holding us, sustaining us, keeping us, and our beautiful Earth, galaxy, solar system, our own spiral dance, whirling through the universe, partnership with other galaxies, rushing across space in an incredible moment of creation. And suddenly we are lifted from our concerns and worries and experience ourselves as a part of the universe. And in that, we stand in wonder at the Creator. I would invite you to begin with me now a journey, a dance, a spiraling dance. We will move out and take a look at broad spectrum of things, and we'll come rushing back in and relate it to our own personal selves and our own personal life, and we'll rush out again. And we may be doing this until whenever. And this might be a beginning for us. And in that beginning, I would like to declare who we are. And this is not my declaration. I just returned from the LCA Synod Planning Event for 1986 and 87. And these are formative words, which are not finished as you connect. We just step out and make a beginning. We just start to dance, stumbling and falling, but trying to get a sense of where we're going. And this might be where we're going and who we are. We, all those of the six directions, are God's people. And we are called and empowered and sent to share our love for God and for each other. And so let us celebrate. Let us begin by celebrating. And I promise I am talking about Indians. Let's celebrate the move into the new church. Indian and non-Indian. Black, Asian, Chicano. Let's celebrate the vision. Let's build trust and fellowship and sharing with ALC and LCA and AELC. Let's also let go and experience the normal grief that is coming over all these changes. Let's be intentional. Let's evangelize. Let's tell and demonstrate, live our love for God and for all the people. Let's continue to create, to affirm and strengthen the existing and strong ministries of our synod and our churches. Let's implement the commitment that we have to inclusiveness and diversity, to celebrating the gifts of God, the visions of an inclusive church. Let's strengthen and support our lay ministries, our volunteers. Let's affirm and build their leadership as we are experiencing it here at Holden and throughout the church. Let's encourage the development of joint mission strategies so that all of us Lutherans will understand our charge, our gift to the rest of the world, this beautiful, beautiful earth. That's the perspective that I would like you to put some of this that I'm presenting into. And the process this morning that I would suggest is a presentation, a bit of information for the first while, and then we will move to some sharing amongst all of you as we try to touch the wisdom that is here. And so, let us begin. The subject that I have been asked to deal with has to do with the original indigenous native peoples in this land. Peoples that have been called American Indian, Native American, and many, many other names, and I'm going to say something more about those names. I started this presentation with a soaring flight around our earth. I began that in terms of this theme of the summer, under God's wing. And as I remember those verses, they describe God as a mother eagle protecting us and keeping us under her wing. And it was rich with images that had power and meaning to me in terms of what we are about and what I am about and why I'm here. And so the journey that I invite you on is one in which we climb on the back right now of a mother eagle. And we fly in a wonderful spiral, touching down and naming some things. And as we go through, we begin to see, as the eagle sees little things from way on high, things look so small, but you see the whole picture. And then maybe there's something moving down there. And then you zoom down for a closer look. And I think that'll be a sense of how to put together what I'm asked to do. Because to talk about American Indian, to talk about Indian, is one of those around the world whirling kinds of experiences, because we are so many and so diverse and so different in many ways, one from the other. And how do you start that journey? And where are you already in it? I'll tell you where I am, just very quickly. I have always been American Indian, Native American, Oglala, Sioux, Lakota. I've been Indian, Lakota, when people said, "You're a dying race." And I said, "I don't think I'm dying yet." I've been Lakota when I was a vanishing race. And I think I wasn't vanishing. I've been Lakota when I didn't live on the reservation. And I wasn't in that place of family and fellowship that is a reservation. So my experience of Indian has been my experience of living and traveling and journeying. Some of you have experienced Indian in that same way, with Indian grandmothers and great-grandmothers, and maybe having lived or been raised on a reservation or in an Indian community. And maybe some of you have only experienced Tonto or the, I can't ever remember the city that has a baseball team with Indians. It's Cleveland Indians. Or maybe, I don't know what you've experienced Indian as. Maybe it's a series of books that you've been reading recently that are number one bestsellers called the White Indian series. I don't know what Indian means to you. In fact, I'm not sure what it means, really, because I have some friends who are from India, and that's a different meaning of Indian. So, names and words that somehow begin to describe something that is Indian. I want to take this eagle flight back today in time, because I have a sense of needing to begin at the beginning. How do we begin with who these people are? How do we get a hold of who they are so that we can learn about them and apply it to ourselves? Well, on your journey, you might go to a bookstore and begin to sample books in that little section that's called Indian Studies. And I mean, there is a whole range of stuff there. And you see names that you may be very familiar with. Navajo, Hopi, Sioux. And you might see some things that you're not familiar with, like Black Elk Speaks or Seven Arrows or Bear, Sun Bear. How do you know what you're going to pick? How do you pick from that range and possibilities and find something about Indians that you can start with? Because there's a lot of stuff out there. You open your eyes and you say, I want to learn more about Indians, and you see things. You see Navajo rugs and Southwestern pottery and Kachina dolls, and you see these warriors with feathers dancing. Where do you begin? How shall we start? Well, you could start with a book that has been recommended by the National Indian Lutheran Board in a packet that was sent out to all ALC pastors, the Indian Concern Sunday 1985 resource packet. There's a list of books in here that you could begin with, place to begin. There's many places to begin. And one of those books is this one, American Indians and Christian Missions. And, well, it's a history book. He's by Henry Warden Bowden, professor of religion at Rutgers University. You could start here. You could start a million places. But for today, I'm going to start with this because I think it's a typical book that you would pull off of a shelf and experience as a first step in beginning a journey, a typical kind of book. And so we begin the journey with ancient civilizations. And we're going to go very quickly as this eagle takes off. And how do you begin? How do you picture a people who don't exist anymore? They have begun by trying to take from physical things that are there and draw pictures of what the people were like who left these physical things. And so this particular book has a tremendous orientation toward graves in this first part, toward the burial sites, towards the evidence of dying and living, particularly the graves. What do they do with their dead? Because that's all we have of them is maybe a grave, gravesite, a way of burying the dead. So we're looking for those early people beginning, and we find graves. We find things buried in the ground, and we sort them out, and we say, well, I found this here, and it's like this, and who put this here? Who is the person that made this? What is the culture and civilization and life that started and left us this thing? And when we do that, we make connections with our own past. We see the pyramids in Egypt or the evidence of the Mesopotamian civilization across. And we try to compare. You know, they have these techniques that they take what's out there and they date it. And they say, well, this many years ago, here was the people, and this is what they did. Well, in North America, the dating that's confirmed is that we had people who went back at least 13,000 years. But it could be, they say, as many as 40,000 to 80,000 years. So we have this technical evidence of today, this scientific process that says, whoever made this piece of pottery or arrowhead goes back at least 13,000 years, and scholars tend to agree that it might be about 40,000 years. And they tell us, how did these people get here? Where did they come from? How do we trace them? And they begin to tell stories about land bridges and days when ice bridged the land between Asia and the United States in this area here in North America. And they open up with a story like that. And it's really interesting to me that they have decided that this is where these people began from. And the reason I say that is because where they find the oldest history of those peoples living is in the middle of the United States, in Colorado. It's an interesting thing to me. How can I do this now? The oldest things that were found in the center of the United States, and they're stone implements, Folsom points, Clovis arrowheads, evidence of a vigorous human life, a people who lived and hunted, a foraging kind of life, and there's evidence that they existed and then they moved and seemed to have spread all over North America. There's evidence of archaic fully developed Homo sapien life all over in every ecology in North America, the early people. And they spread. And so you begin to see over this beautiful east, north, south, west, peoples living, traveling, growing. It's a vigorous existence, a moving, a changing, a spread all over North America. We have in the central heart of the United States evidence of a people called the Cochise people who had a foraging existence. The Hohokam, who had an existence of irrigation. They settled, they grew, they brought the water, they understood the connection between water and life and food. And apparently they burned all of their dead. And then from that we take, who were these people? How did they get here? What was their life? We don't know. We just know a little bit. We have the Mogollons. Is that how you say it? Is anybody?
We call it in Arizona the Mogollon or the Rim. Is that?
The Rim, yeah. But I've never heard it. I didn't center it and say, this is how you say it.
Yeah.
But people who had discovered particular plants that could keep life alive, the corn, the beans, the squash, food, and they began to do farming. There were people living, and we don't even know, how do you call them? How do you name them? You know, there's no one there to say, well, this is my name. And so they get named. And maybe their name isn't exactly a representation of who they were. We image them as we fly back and we picture them, but we don't know exactly what they are. We have the Anasazi, a people who developed a system. They built from beginnings of mud and plastered, growing and building apartment-type houses. Sacred places built. We find places that are built in, sacred places built in to their lives. we find a people who organized life so well that they had a strong population, a population that could stay in one place. We find a people who had a story about how they became, how they were created, who built things not just to live and eat and sleep, but to build things to express something within, a spiritual center. What does this have to do with us as we take our spiral dance now and we've flown over ancient peoples and built things, sacred things, more to life than survival, but something more, the Anasazi, who give us a cosmology, a story of what they are in the universe, who show by their care of burying the dead, who show in the way that the bodies are arranged, who show evidence of having taken something from cultures and civilizations in Middle America and incorporating it into their lives. Somehow they're people living out a life there. And we also see that something happened somewhere. A decline, a movement, a change, a disappearance. Why? Where did they go? What happened? What do we know about that? And in this book, he talks about how these peoples didn't disappear and vanish, but exist in some ancestral form in the lives of people who are still alive today. He talks about the, and you helped me because you're in the area, the Hohokam?
Hohokam, yeah.
Hohokam. He says, exists still in forms of the Pima and Papago people. He says the Mogollon still exist in the lives of the Zuni. And the Anasazi, who have often been lifted up as not being anywhere, somehow disappeared in no continuity with them in any modern forms. I had heard that. But he talks about them existing today still in the lives of the Hopi. Some sense of connectedness between those ancient earliest peoples and people who are still alive today, the Hopi people, the people of the Pueblos. He talks about the ancient cultures that were in the east, in the woodland area, and we're going to run out of time for talking about this, and so I'm not going to keep going too much longer, except because I want you to have some sharing here, but I want to paint a picture of peoples. They're the woodland peoples, cultures that are called the Adena, and again, you might be better at these words because they're just words on a paper to me. They're not words in my ears as much as I would like them to be. The Hopewell, the Mississippian cultures, peoples who lived, and in living built, and in building shared and taught. And we have a people who created structures for worship. Some structures for worship that describe what happens to them after life, and others who created structures for worship that describes what happens in life. Different orientations. And we have a history of changes. We have tremendous exciting mysteries. The effigy mound the mound builders in the woodland culture, the people who made these incredible shapes that we didn't even see until we got the ability to fly over them. The serpent mound builders, the people who built earthworks that expressed more than life, more than eating and sleeping and bearing children, but something more. I was excited to go to a bookstore and pick up a book like this and just begin to touch down on the lives of ancient peoples, and that's only the first chapter. I invite you to share now, having just evoked images of ancestors of Indians. What do you do with that? As we spiraled out and described the ancient ones, I want this day to be somewhat contained. What does that, did that lift anything up to you? What did we do with that? What did you bring to mind when I talked about, did you have an experience in your life having been down to Southwest and seen the ancestors, or have you seen the mounds, or do you have a sense of?
This was the first time that we had been, that I had been in Southwest, and I was amazed at the, what was it, the Montezuma? The well.
Oh, that Montezuma's castle, which is a...
Montezuma castle and the well. You know, I was just amazed at the degree of, I want to say civilization, maybe that isn't the right word, but how well developed their form of life and the things, you know, and the agriculture, the irrigation. It was a revelation to me, but you wonder where they are, what happened. They just seem to disappear from that area. But maybe they're in the rest of it somewhere.
How interesting and exciting it would be to keep digging into that, to learn more and to find and understand. I don't know. I just am so excited to dig into these different areas. Because, you know, I said to you in the beginning, I'm Indian. But, you know, how would I know what those people are like, except unless I do this, just explore.
The average white man's idea now is that the Indians were pretty primitive and savage, pardon me for saying so, but when you go through that herd museum down there in Phoenix, which if you're ever in Phoenix, one ought to do, and you ought also, if you ever get to Seattle and out to Suquamish to see the museum there, is to see the skill which the people exhibited in their type of life, like their basket making and their whatever, weaving for cloth and clothes. And I mean, you take a pretty skillful Norwegian to do pretty much what some of those Indians did, I'll tell you.
I'm a Norwegian,
me too.
Sweden's smart enough, but I'm a Norwegian to be. And then the Kachina dolls, which represent spirit as far as they were concerned. But the skill which those dolls were made, and the number of them, and I think those in the Heard Museum are probably bona fide dolls, not just commercial dolls that are being sold. The things I saw there, and then I've been in that area in eastern United States, Nashville. I went into a museum there, a trading village, and they had made baskets. I bought Marilyn and gave it to her. It's just skillfully done. They are not without Yeah, a whole civilization that was probably as well-developed as it could have been. And of course, we know about the Aztecs and the people in South America who had really high civilization.
Not being a Native American myself, but I just feel a sense of pride. That's what it kind of stirred up in me. These are wonderful accomplishments, something that I want to be proud of and learn more about.
Infant over the years, and I haven't thought about this for a long time, but I grew up in Southern Illinois, and close by was a place called Cahokia Mounds, which were a set of mounds made by Indians, and the impression that we used to take field trips there all the time to school was that they did go fight, you know, with the swanages that they used baskets, so that there's some big mounds that was just one basketball at a time. It's huge. They built without bulldozers or anything. I really thought about that, but I was really impressed by that.
What were the purpose of the mounds?
They were something ceremonial with religious work, because they have most of Illinois flat, and their villages were in flat, but they were these mounds that were built for mound meeting purposes.
And also, last Friday, the last day of school, we went down the Surin, got on the little boat. We went to the petroglyphs that were drawn by Indians. And we went, there was two, and one of them was, we were looking for it on the side. We could get pretty close because the lake's so steep. It's just right off center. And we looked, and one of them, and all that we saw was vandalism. But then after we looked for a few minutes, we could start seeing like the little drawings. So it kind of seemed like the vandalism, kind of in the graffiti camp. Just kind of, you didn't even, first bit we saw, we were just looking, and they go, oh, look at the vandalism. And we kind of almost went right by it. And then we get a little closer, and then we started seeing things. They have all the different, the people that they drew and the different animals and things. So I think, like, the graffiti kind of meant, I don't know what, but it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of set it off or something like that. But we don't need to go down and look at it. It's supposed to be really old. You're drawing pictures of people and animals, which are funny, that they've never seen before. That they've seen before, but they're so interested that they get pictures.
I just finished reading a book called Blue Highways, which is written by an Indian who travels, makes a big circle all around the United States, and when he comes to Washington, he visits Petroglyphs. And he puts his finger, to trace the drawing, and to put his finger in the indentations in the rocks, and just describes the feeling that he has of another man like him standing there and drawing the drawings, and how it was such an overwhelming feeling for him that he wasn't expecting. What you're describing of that feeling coming all through the ages and all through time, as if he somehow now knew that man or woman who had stood there and made those drawings.
So that if we can connect with something as many generations back as that, we can also maybe even see that we are those petroglyph writers for those generations that are way ahead, yet to come.
association that I have is, related to this book I mentioned last night. It's called Changing Woman and All Her Sisters. The author's name is Sheila Moon. And close to a year ago, I looked at it for the first time, and I started giving it to women clients who were struggling with women's issues, and then with a lot of other books that I, in fact, I have a whole list that I. But the interesting thing was that this book universally has spoken to them. And it's a collection of Hopi and Navajo mythology. And it has spoken to them more about women's issues today than any other book that this group has read. And that has more than books like Boland's book, Goddesses and Everyone, and so forth, which is another current book that women are reading.
What was that last one?
Boland, Goddesses and Every Woman. It's also a very important book for women. It talks about a lot of the themes that are moving in women today. Only uses Greek mythology as the connection. Anyway, I guess what it brought to my own attention again was how much a part of what was moving inwardly with the people that you have been talking about, Janice, is a part of us, and how much we haven't seen that or understood that. I think that, at least in America, and I can't really speak it for any other place, I've lived in some other places, but I haven't worked intensely with people in other places, that the earth in America is red, and that's part of us in a way in which it maybe isn't, maybe it's a part of other people's too. Could well be, I just don't know much about that. And so it's fascinating to begin to think about how these peoples, which we've given all kinds of names to, like the Hohokam, I'm trying to remember what that means. I mean, the lost people or something. I mean, they didn't call themselves Hohokam,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right?
That was a name we gave to them. Is that true of most tribes and so forth? Did they name themselves, or did we mostly? Did European settlers name?
That lots of times it seems to have been the naming by one tribe of other tribes that may in fact have been sort of enemies.
I see.
So that the Oglala are the people who are like a bunch of women who throw sand between their legs so that they won't get raped or made love to.
That's what Oglala
means. That's what Oglala means.
Oh,
so the Oglala people would name themselves Lakota. And so most peoples have their own naming of themselves, and more people are beginning to name their own names. The associations are, the stories of how a name got a name is fascinating, and I'll try to lift some of those out. And that's part of why I'm doing it this way, to lift up a couple of concerns that I have in terms of where do you begin to learn what Indian is. You begin with whatever you have, but you pray for a spirit of discernment and an ability to stay with it long enough to perceive through, you know, is Indian Tonto, or are the Oglalas Oglala, or, you know, is share the image of Indian for American women today, or you know, is this Cleveland Indian, or you know, the noble savage, or the vanishing race, the squaw, or you know, where did those names come from? Where did you get that? What is it? Why do you experience Indian in whatever way it is for you? A journey.
A week once with a Potawatomi medicine man, and he said that their people had originally called themselves the Earth People. And, which was, I thought, kind of interesting.
What did you mean when you said the color of the American soil is red? Because of the blood spilled?
No, it's because of the influence of these peoples and their religion, their culture, their myth. It's like it's, you know, as we've talked this week, psyche isn't confined to time and space as we know it or usually refer to it. So there's a sense in which the earth contains psyche. That's another issue, because we've tended to split spirit and matter apart, but these earth people knew that they went together, right? Interesting. They belong together, and so when we pray today, we pray not only for people, but for the earth, and as this Potawatomi Indian would always do, for all my relatives. We'd always end every prayer, and for all my relatives, which he meant, you know, not just people, but the birds and the animals and the earth. So there's a sense in which our soil in America contains, I think, the space that we live in contains whatever was moving with these people.
And it's very much part of my exploration now to sense that we also are connected to those indigenous peoples who still survive all over the world, and that the struggles that you will discover as you discover Indian are the same struggles that are going on all over the world for other indigenous peoples. It is for those sisters and mothers and fathers and children in Central and South America who are experiencing a continuous death that I cover my hair today. I cover my hair in solidarity with the Aboriginal indigenous peoples in Australia and those native peoples in Southern Africa and throughout Africa, those mothers who are experiencing the death and dying that comes, I think. I'm beginning to be able to say that I think that the death and dying of the suffering of those people all over the world and also in our country are things that are coming because we have lost, some of us, the awareness of who our own ancestors are and what our own ancient peoples are, and that the fact that we have risen up as sacred life, moving out and across and around and spiraling back in an incredible dance. It's so much fun to see people who came out spiraling out away from their centers to travel to the United States are now returning to home, to their own culture, to their native languages, so that maybe we're all native indigenous peoples, either wandering or returning home or sending out in some way. I think that the history of the American Indians, to seek and try to understand the Hohokam, the Anasazi, the Mississippian, the mound builders, is to see what kind of mounds we're building and to see what monuments, what pyramids and statues and skyscrapers we're building and why. What does it tell us about our relationship to each other and to Earth and to creation? Why do we build nuclear weapons? So, anything else that we have some time to begin? What would you like to say about Indian based on this first day of orientation discussion?
When you ask about connections, whatever they are, it comes back when they asked me to teach a course in literature of the North. When I had just come to Alaska and I hadn't read one book on the literature of the North, and in 2 weeks I had to teach it. And, but rather than just have it only on the literature of the North, I decided to bring in as much, as many speakers from the natives, because it's divided into three classes, the Aleuts, the Eskimos, and the Indians. And so quite a bit of it was bringing in as many native speakers and craftspeople, and then having the students, having them teach the students, show them their crafts, and let the students make things. And I remember from Haynes, this young Indian, was a carver, and so he spoke about his work, and then he had the student, he let the students do some carving, and I brought the mask I had bought when I was in Haynes. It was the bear mask, and as soon as he saw it, he said, "My Uncle Mark carved that." And there was nothing inside, if anything inside the one. But he immediately recognized that it was his uncle. And I remember Frank, who came from Indian, who came from Metlakatla and spoke about the history of Metlakatla. And I was thinking about went way back as far as he could, as he knew. And I got the feeling, well, that was their first. That was their land. And then an Indian from a teacher at the University in Seattle came up and offered a course in Indian. He was teaching Indian mythology. And that was another experience, because that was the mythology of the lower 48, like we call it up there. You know, of the Southwest, and it was the mythology, which is really interesting. And those are my connections, my experiences.
Thank you for sharing that.
What do Native Americans prefer to be called in there? What is that here?
Well, I think it's the range of people. Is extensive, from those who believe in just being American, not needing to define themselves as Indian. There are those who say, you know, I'm just an American, just like everybody else, no different. To those who, you know, and it just rushes down through the whole spectrum, to those who seek to preserve an ancestral, traditional, non-changed, non-impacted lifestyle, and all stages in between. And so then, depending on where you're at, you might name yourself, and it would be real important to be sensitive to the kinds of self-naming that people do. And we who have names and have people pronounce them or forget them or name you incorrectly. Know that it means something to be given that right to name yourself. And so I name myself Lakota. But I also own all those other names that are a part of me, because they tell my history and they tell where I'm coming from and they give me direction for where I'm going. And another thing about that is in terms of history. One of the problems that you have is that history is his story, and we do not have a good handle on her story. And so I don't just take a really good history like this one, a real scholarly history, a real high quality study, and say that's it. That isn't it. Because her story, the stories of the women, who, the way the women would tell these stories and name themselves, these people, isn't there. And it isn't available to me. And it isn't, this isn't the Lakota history of the early people. This isn't the Navajo history of the beginning of peoples. This isn't the history you can't get a handle on. Nobody can go back there and say, this is what it was. This is what happened. This is what they believed and the way they talked and the way they lived. You can only kind of think what it is. And it changes. If you would have picked up a book about Indians 100 years ago and read the history of that, or if you talk to a Mormon and say, what is the history of the Indian people? You don't get the same thing. And so it's a spirit of discernment. And it's a wondering, and it's a mystery, and it's a seeking. And what will it be like on the days when those people who are now Navajo and Pima and Papago and Zuni tell their story about the ancient ones, the elders? Will it be the same story as these? This fine historian at Rutgers University? Or will they give us some other dimensions of this story that would be, make it a different story? I'm here for 15 sessions, and I will be doing, it's so hard to get into a subject like this. It's a little difficult, but the next time it is to get in a little deeper to the Pueblo people and what they were like when those early Spanish missionaries found them, and then what happened to them when those early Spanish missionaries came and impacted their lives. But to lay the foundation of a people who moved and grew and believed and declined and disappeared and took on new cultures, a long history of change and growth, and most importantly, if I had to pick one word, a vigorous life, a full, abundant life that was here, rich in culture and intelligence and creativity, a vital existence that was already here as we look back and try to understand about today. You see, we're here today with Indians and non-Indians and treaties and Bolt decision and in Wisconsin, the And how do we make sense out of that? Well, we started with this one swing out in a dance of swinging back to the past to see how to make sense. And we're going to keep going on here and move forward in time and to the future and across space to name some of these other people, the Pueblo and civilized tribe, the Seminole, the Cherokee, the Iroquois, the Huron, the Hoopa, the people in the Southwest, and so on. Lots of people. What is Indian? What is Indian? And how can we sit down in 15 sessions and talk about that? We can't, but we can begin a journey, a dance of celebration of life. I'm going to share some things before I go. This is available to you in your own home congregations in AOC and LCA. It comes out of the LCA National Division of Parish Services, I think. But it's also available, well, I get my ALC and LCA mixed up, but pretty soon it won't matter. You can get it. You can write me and get it. And this is a resource packet that has worship and books, publications, quotes, prayers, litany, all kinds of things for you to participate in this journey, this dance with your own congregation. My 15 sessions are built on this book for the first 8 sessions, which is a history that is told from the perspective of a non-Indian. And then the second series is from this book, Now That the Buffalo's Gone, by Alvin Josephy. And that's a different perspective, a study of today's American Indian, and hopefully be able to pull through that tension and dualism between telling my own story and having somebody tell you my story, which may not exactly come up with the same story. And maybe there's some truth in both tellings, I think. This is a document that was adopted at the Toronto Convention of the Lutheran Church in America. It's called Inclusiveness and Diversity, Gifts of God. This is a declaration and specific commitments and goals which were approved for the whole of the Lutheran Church in America. And in our Pacific Northwest Synod, we have made this a major commitment to implement this this document in the LCA. And to do that, each element at every level of the church is invited to act in a beautiful spiral dance of growth. The Lutheran Church Women's Synodical Movement units have a manual which helps them to begin to dance clumsily, uncertainly maybe at the beginning, but to reach out. Congregational level church women organizations have a manual that has been given to them in the LCA. And ALC is free to use anything that we're doing and don't reinvent the wheel. Coalitions of minority group peoples have a resource. Synods have commitments and strategies to begin this exciting process of bringing into the Lutheran Church all of those other beautiful cultures and languages and peoples and gifts that God has given us. Colleges, social ministry organizations, everyone is invited to begin to participate in the experience of broadening our own lives, and it is a joyful dance. The ALC, on the other hand, lifts up the vision. This is a document called Visions of an Inclusive Church that is available through your synods, and it lifts up the vision and describes what it would be like if we had a more inclusive church, a diverse church. And as a church, reached out to the inclusive and diverse experiences, the gifts of God that are out there in the world for us. And then I have just a couple of other things in terms of marching orders. What can you do if you're leaving today and you're not going to hear any more of this or something? You're leaving in the next couple of days. I lift two documents. One, the progress report number 5 from the Commission for a New Lutheran Church, a narrative description. Here's a place to begin by beginning to be involved in the work of building a new church. Because the new church is an experience in getting out and creating. And by creating, I think transforming Lutheranism in America. And I lift this up to you to take it and be empowered to build a new church with it from your own perspective. And there is a report out from last year so that you can get history and background of how things happen. So I would, just a few that I brought to share with you, to be empowered in your own church to experience our dance together.